The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
And now, Sports Talk 1240.
All right, folks, welcome back for the second hour of Sports Talk 1240. I'm Derek Wozniak. Across the way is John Sweeney. You're with Sweeney and the Woz on a Sunday night. Second half of two power-packed hours of Sports Talk. And Andrew Joseph touched on in the first hour how, you know, in New York, I mean, baseball, listen, the Mets haven't done anything since 2006. The Yankees, for a team that spends $500 million a year, last 2 years have been horrible. The Brooklyn Nets, they're under 500. The Knicks, did the Knicks even have a team? Didn't they fold the franchise yesterday? I thought they folded up after that loss. And the Jets and Giants, the last 2 years, the Giants have a couple Super Bowls. But in New York, the Rangers have won 13 out of 14. One of the best stretches in team history dating back to the 1973-74, the disco days. I was only 4 or 5 years old back then. And the Islanders have 28 wins, and they sit in first place in the Metropolitan Division. So I figured the best way to start the show would be to express mine and my partner's feelings about hockey in New York, and this song best expresses it. We're going to raise it up a little more for you. And as we play the song, because this is the way I certainly like it, folks, I like it when hockey is number one in this town, because right now, this is a hockey town. I don't care what the masses follow. If you enjoy following a team that's 5-35, congratulations in basketball. If you enjoy involving yourself with a football team, the New York Jets that I love and my partner loves, that's been a better part of the last 3+ years, an embarrassment and a circus show, good for you. But the Rangers went to the Stanley Cup last year, the semifinals a couple of years before that. The Islanders, playoff competitors 2 years ago last year, their superstar John Tavares got hurt. You know, and they were, sitting to a little tailspin, but this year they acquired a goalie, their coach, you know the whole nine yards. We covered it the last couple of shows.
Yes, we did.
And look at the Islanders now.
Surging. First place.
And today's going to be an NFL-filled 60 minutes with us, but this song is just about the way we feel. And watching Peyton Manning implode today and not have one of his better days as the upstart Colts and the future star, the present star of Andrew Luck, take control of their path towards a title by not only winning one playoff game, but now two after the first couple of years and a couple of struggles.
Third year in the season.
For Andrew Luck. Now he goes on the road and gets a big win for himself.
Let's hope he goes up to New England and takes care of that business up there.
Now how about that, John?
Let's go to New England and take care of New England.
Broncos get beat at home. So Peyton Manning can't get it done last year. In the Super Bowl, he gets throttled by the Seahawks.
Blown out.
And then this year, when everybody thinks, here it comes, Peyton Manning up to New England to try and slay the dragon known as Tom Brady on the road and get back to another Super Bowl, try and be the first quarterback to win with two different teams. Andrew Luck has other ideas. And listen, the Broncos could not convert on third down to save their life.
Nope.
And the Colts, a bad defense as it was this year, holding them less than 100 yards rushing. The Broncos scored on their first drive of the game.
And that was, yeah.
Early in the first quarter, they scored.
And a couple of field goals after that.
Nothing after that. No touchdowns.
I'm surprised that Denver just didn't run the ball down their throat. That guy Gray on the Patriots ran for 4 touchdowns against the Colts. And I thought it was going to be run. For Denver, and they went the opposite way. Manning was overthrowing everybody.
He was off. John, we watched the game together. He was off all day.
All day.
He was misfiring.
He had Sanders open a couple of times. He overthrew him. He was off all day. But hey, look, you got to give Andrew Luck. He's a young guy, third year in the league, and, he's exciting. He's good for football. I like him a lot. He's going to take that team up to New England now, and let's hope, because we're Jet fans. Let's just hope that he could take care of the evil
I'll be rooting against the Patriots this week.
Me too. I root against the
Patriots
every week.
I mean, I won't root for any team out of the AFC to win a Super Bowl, but I'll root against the Pats.
I go against New England every week.
Just being
because they're cheaters. Belichick's a cheater, but...
And you're sporting your Aaron Rodgers jersey.
Wearing my Aaron Rodgers jersey.
He took care of business with a bad leg and all against the Dallas Cowboys today. A little controversy there. Maybe we'll get to that later on.
Well, no matter what, the four teams that are in it will be a good Super Bowl.
And excellent games. Listen, the Ravens blew it last night. 2 14-point leads. They couldn't hold on. The Pats come back and beat them 28. What was the final score? 35-31 was the final score there. But I'll tell you, at 28-21, when the Pats called that wide receiver option pass for a touchdown, that was it, man. I'll tell you, Tom Brady, his offensive play calling and his offensive execution, just flawless. As usual.
Yeah, as usual. He's
and
great.
And then Seattle comes out and takes care of business at night. And takes it to Carolina. Close for a while, but in the fourth quarter, you know, Seattle's defense proved to be way too much. And Russell Wilson is a great young quarterback in this league. Right? So you're seeing a possible back-to-back title run for the Seahawks. And they have vaunted defense.
And like we talked about earlier, Russell Wilson's he's a likable guy, you know. So he's not a guy like you could actually, some of these other guys you like, you know, the quarterbacks in the league, you want them to lose, but Russell Wilson's a kind of likable guy.
Right.
Seattle, you know, he was drafted in the third round, came out, won a Super Bowl. I mean, you know, we'll see what happens this year. If he comes back. All four of those teams are going to be good.
It's going to be great.
It's going to be a good
Super
Bowl.
It really is. So Green Bay goes to Seattle next week, and the Colts go up to New England to play. Colts defense played great today. The Seahawks defense was great last night. But I'm going to take you back to the time where the best defenses reigned in the 80s. And we're going to talk a lot tonight about the 86 G-Men defense.
Oh, yeah.
And it is my pleasure to welcome to the show two-time Pro Bowler, two-time Super Bowl champion with the Giants, a member of that dominant defense of 1986, where he had two sacks in the Super Bowl, Leonard Marshall, number 70, joining the show. How are you, Leonard?
I'm doing great, guys. How y'all doing?
How you doing, Leonard?
We are so happy to have you on the show. Leonard, I don't care what anybody wants to talk about. In today's day and age, bigger, stronger, faster athletes, whatever it is. In the 80s, it was all about the Giants, the Bears, the Redskins, and the 49ers. And listen, in terms of defenses, none better than the two I witnessed in back-to-back years. The 85 Bears and the 86 Giants. And the biggest memory I had of Leonard Marshall, number 70, is he played in two championship games, and he played in two Super Bowls. And those four games combined, you had six sacks, which in my mind, watching those games, Mr. Clutch on the defensive line, playing with George Martin and obviously Jim Burt. Let's go back, though. You were born in Louisiana, Leonard, right? As a young guy coming up, who got you into sports in terms of playing football?
Well, you know, it was guys in the neighborhood. You know, I got blessed and embraced by guys in the neighborhood that really, you know, took a liking to me. They saw I was a kid that, you know, could go some places and do some things. You know, I was pretty disciplined as a young guy and not a follower, a leader in my own right, and just a guy that, you know, was looking to carve out a path for himself that he could kind of follow. And you know, the good thing about it is I had a couple of role models early on. I had a guy named Wallace Francis who had come from my hometown and had made it, you know, successfully in the National Football League by hooking up with the Buffalo Bills and then moving on from the Bills and finishing his career in Atlanta with the Atlanta Falcons. So, you know, I had some pretty solid role models around me.
All right, so as a young guy, because obviously you went to college late 70s, early 80s, but growing up as a young guy playing football, who were some of your idols growing up?
Some of my idols were like, you know, relatives. My cousin Ernie Ladd was a player with the Kansas City Chiefs. My other cousin Warren Wells was a player with the Oakland Raiders back on those bad boy teams the Raiders had. And, you know, and it was basically, you know, guys in the neighborhood that really took a strong liking to me. You know, my bitty basketball coach was a guy that really took a liking to me. There's another guy that's a Hall of Fame football coach in Louisiana by the name of Richard Dick McCloskey that coached a parochial school, a Class A school called Hanson High School that really took a liking to me and made sure that, you know, I got a chance to do some things in my life and, you know, really go the right way instead of going the wrong way. And I think that was a big thing for me was people really embraced me in a positive, You know, coming from, you know, the South, as deep in the South as you can get, where it was racially divided, but yet not so much to the tune where sports didn't ring loud. You know, sports was a common denominator and a meeting ground, no matter what color, nationality, denomination you came from. You know, when they threw that ball up in the air, you guys were all the same color, you were all the same, and you fought hard and played against each other as if you were the same.
Okay, so growing up in Louisiana, did you root for the Saints, or were you more partial to a different sport, or was football your thing in terms of following pro teams?
You know, it's funny, as a kid, you know, my dad was a Dallas Cowboy fan, and I kind of got deeper into the Steelers as life went on, and times grew because of Mel Blunt and Terry's, and I kind of got deeper into the Steelers as life went on, and times grew because of Mel Blunt and Terry Bradshaw and a few guys from Louisiana who had made it and hooked on with the Steelers and won a few championships with the Steelers. So that was my thing. He was giving it to my dad because my dad was, you know, Mr. No, it ain't going to happen. No, that won't work.
See, I went with my dad. My dad was a big Jet fan. I was a Jet fan. Big Ranger fan in hockey, big Ranger fan. So you went with the Steel Curtain. Would it be fair to say that being Joe Green was one of your favorite players then?
You know, Joe Green was one of my favorites. Jack Lambert was my all-time favorite because I was a linebacker in high school. So,
okay. Me too.
A linebacker
right.
who kind of every now and then would put his hand on the ground and act like Randy White almost, but yet not play like Randy White.
Right. All right, so you got a scholarship to go play at LSU, right?
And
Yes, I did. You majored in business management.
Yes, I did.
Right, so you finished your degree while you were in college playing football.
I actually finished it while being on the Giants. I actually finished my education at Fairleigh Dickinson University in Hackensack, New Jersey.
Oh, okay.
And March cap and gown right after my second championship with the Giants.
All right, so at LSU, you played in the SEC, a lot of tough matchups year in and year out. You're going up against the best competition. Any memories, any famous players that you played with?
Oh, wow. I mean, I could think of tons. I could think of playing USC my freshman year, and I get in the game as a linebacker slash defensive lineman. And, you know, we end up playing USC in Baton Rouge. We kept the game close into the fourth quarter. We actually had a shot to win the game going in the fourth quarter. Had a... Our quarterback at the time, David Woodley, who went on to play for the Miami Dolphins,
yeah.
Had he been able to connect with Carlos Carson on a play that got reversed in the game, we would have beat USC. But the final score ended up 17-12 and USC prevailing. And USC had everybody. They had Ronnie Lott. They had one of the Browner brothers. They had the safety, I'm trying to think of the kid's name that played for the Broncos in our first Super Bowl stint. I want to say Dennis Smith. They had Marcus Allen. They had Charles White. They had Hobie Brenner at tight end. They had McDonald at quarterback.
Right.
They just had a little bit of everybody at USC. They had all the big linemen, Keith Van Horn, Brad Buddy, Anthony Munoz, Chris Foote. They just had everybody, man.
I mean, that's two of the greatest of all time between Anthony Munoz and Ronnie Lott. I mean, he's
I mean, we held them. I mean, we hung in there with them for four quarters, and the final score was 17-12. But the score wasn't indicative of the game because I mean, we took it to them that day.
And then 1982, you lost in the Orange Bowl, but you were for the 1982 season. You were named team defensive MVP. Is that true?
Yes, I was MVP of the team and defensive MVP of the team. That team beat Alabama. That team was a team that had finally beaten Bear Bryant, and
right.
And the final score, I believe, was 22-10. But the score in that game was not indicative of the game itself. We held Alabama to like 8 yards offense on the ground, and
wow.
I knocked a quarterback out. We knocked two of the running backs out. I mean, there's plays in the film. If you watch our defense play, there's plays in the film where we had all 11 bodies hitting their running back at the same time. I mean, that's just how tenacious our defense was and committed the guys were on that team. And that team yielded about 7 of those guys went on to play in the NFL, from Ramsey Dardar to Lifford Hobley to Eugene Daniels with the Colts to James Britt with the Falcons. Billy Elko went to San Diego with the Chargers. Tim Joyner went to the Houston Oilers. Albert Richardson was drafted and signed as a free agent with the Broncos. Let me see who else. Lawrence Williams went on to play in the USFL. Jeffrey Dale ended up being a third-round pick of the San Diego Chargers the next season. I mean, we just had a whole host of kids that were really good student athletes.
Right. Now, you mentioned one of the guys that went on to the USFL. That had started up around that time. Now, I know the SEC was one big conference, and you only played 6 or 7, like, in-conference games for a regular season. But did you ever get a chance to play against Herschel Walker?
I didn't play Herschel Walker, but I got a chance to play James Brooks.
Okay.
Joe Cribbs. I got a chance to play Bo Jackson. I got a
from
chance
Auburn,
to play,
yeah.
Yep. I got a chance to play, what's the kid's name at Alabama? I'm trying to think of his name. Stephen Shealy. I got a chance to play, EJ Jr. Let me see who else. At Alabama. I'm trying to think, Leonard. Got a chance to play James Jones at Florida. Got a chance to play Wilbur Marshall at Florida. Got
Wilbur
a chance
Marshall,
to play
yeah.
David Galloway at Florida. Got a chance to play Wayne Peace
right.
and Bob Huco at Florida. And who else was at Florida? I'm trying to think. A receiver. Chris Collinsworth.
Oh, yep.
Well, being
a big-time defender, was Bo Jackson the toughest guy you ever went against in college?
Bo Jackson was a hell of a football player, but Joe Cribbs was a little bit more trickier. And I tell you, he was a, who was even more trickier was Willie Gault at Tennessee. I mean, Willie Gault and Reggie White and the Tennessee Volunteers back in the day,
right.
They were the only team that we had tied that year in 1982. And, you know, Willie Gault was the guy that kept them in the game.
Yeah,
Willie
Joe Cribbs
was a football player in college.
Joe Cribbs was real good with the Buffalo Bills. I remember him up there.
Yes, he was.
But,
he was, and James Brooks as well.
Yeah, Brooks played for Cincinnati a while,
yep,
too, Brooks right?
Played
yeah,
played for Cincinnati. I'm trying to think of another. There were a number of guys. I'm trying to think of some of the other guys that were playing back during those times. But Lomas Brown,
yeah.
he was a Florida guy. David Galloway, I'm trying to think of.
I thought Herschel Walker was the best I'd ever seen.
Oh, Herschel Walker was unbelievable. I wanted to play him. Believe me, I wanted to play him. I wanted to play him in the worst way. You know, that's what you want when you're in college. You want to play the best. Because if you play the best, you get a chance to measure yourself against someone.
Right, so now you finish up college, defensive player of the year for your team, big-time college football, SEC, and all that.
I make all SEC. I get mentioned for All-American and all that other good
right.
stuff.
Now, the 1983 draft rolls around, and everybody, when they think of it, there's been some documentaries, they think of the 83 quarterback draft class. Okay? But
yeah.
Leonard Marshall is drafted in the second round that year by the New York Giants. Now, they already had a couple of pieces in place for that big-time defense that was developing and working towards titles. They had Harry Carson from the 76 draft right around there, and obviously in 81, they drafted Lawrence Taylor. But in 83, they draft Leonard Marshall, and two of the quarterbacks in that first round, you happened to beat in Super Bowls, John Elway and Jim Kelly.
Absolutely.
So now, talk to me about the whole experience getting drafted by the Giants and coming to your first, training camp and all that.
Well, it's funny. It's funny you say that. The one thing that I remember about it was, you know, when you go on the tour and you're being recruited and you're going to the different combines to work out and you're working out with all these different guys and you see all these different guys and you see all these talents that you heard of in college and, you know, some of the guys you played against, like, you know, I got a chance to play Dave Remington in the Orange Bowl and shut him out. Got a chance to play Mike Rozier and got a chance to play Jamie Williams, the tight end who went on to play for San Francisco and Houston. Got a chance to play against that great quarterback they had that really didn't get a shot, that kid Turner Gill and Irving Fryer and a few other guys. But that quarterback thing with Elway and O'Brien and Marino and Blackledge and Tony Eason and all those guys.
Right.
Kind of rubbed me the wrong way because, you know, I was the fourth defensive lineman drafted, and the three guys that went ahead of me, I didn't think were that style of football players to begin with, you know, in college. You know, Jim Jeffcoat and Gabe Rivera and Mike Pitts at the time, although I did respect them, I just didn't think that they were style of player, and I didn't think that they could bring to the teams that drafted them what I thought I could bring to the New York Giants. And it was indicative as, you know, as things started to grow and the year started to transcend, you know, who was going to end up getting the better end of the deal. And I'll never forget my trip to the Raiders to visit the Raiders and visit with Al Davis. And the one thing that Mr. Davis said to me, Leonard, if you're here in the first round, believe me, you're our guy. We want somebody to play opposite Howie Long. We want somebody that can move up and down the line of scrimmage like Howie and give other offenses a fit. In terms of them trying to block him and trying to figure out where both of you guys are. And I really was excited about being a Raider. But when the Giants called and the Giants took the shot, and Bill Parcells had already had told me, if you're around anywhere in the first round, you know, and we get our chance to pick, we're going to try to get you. And, you know, and when that thing blew up, I just knew I was going to end up being a Raider. And the next thing I know, the Raiders draft a center by the name of Don Mosbar from SC with a bad back and all, and called me to apologize, but said that they thought I'd be there in the second round. It just didn't happen. You know, the Giants had scooped me up, and Parcells had already told me he was going to trade Gary Jeter to the Rams because he had found a home for Gary Jeter, and, you know, he was going to a 3-4 defense, and he felt like I was the prototype guy to come in and help him try to get to a championship level. So I was happy, you know, elated by it, excited about the opportunity. Playing in New York is obviously a kid's dream, especially if you get a chance to play in a big sports town and you know you can bring your A game to an organization, and having a chance to play next to, you know, a potential Hall of Fame linebacker in Lawrence Taylor and help elevate his game to another level, and he in turn motivate me to bring my A game week in and week out. I knew it would be something that would kind of work out for
right.
the both of us.
And you're there in the, you know, 3-4 defense, the big time front seven of the Giants. Now you with George Martin and Jim Burt. We already know that LT was there with Harry Carson. The year after your draft, in 84, the Giants took Carl Banks in the first round, and then they grabbed a few rounds later Gary Reasons. And there you go. There's the front seven. So tell me what it was like, training camps, practices, with that crew of seven guys and the experience with Belichick and, you know, Parcells.
Tell me when we started to add pieces to the puzzle, I mean, you know, it became quite clear that you know, we were going to be someone to be reckoned with, especially in the NFCs, no doubt. I mean, when Carl came, you know, a 6'5", 250-pound linebacker that could run the 40 in 4.5 seconds, and then we get, you know, in 85, we get Reasons, and we get a receiver in Lionel Manuel, and we turn around, and we get 86, we get four picks in the first three rounds, and Mark Collins, Pepper Johnson, Eric Howard, and Eric Dorsey. I knew that we were going to be someone special, and then I knew it was starting to turn. And, you know, 85 became a little bit more apparent for us that we needed a couple of more pieces of the puzzle in order to go to the next level.
Right.
I mean, I had 15.5 sacks, was defensive lineman of the year, NFL defensive lineman of the year, NFC defensive lineman of the year, and everything else. But
right.
those personal accomplishments over, you know, couldn't be overshadowed more by the fact that, you know, we were a team of destiny, and there were more things that we wanted to accomplish as a team. And I wanted to see that team thing happen more than the personal accolades and
right.
everything else. You know, I was probably one of the most unselfish football players to ever play on the New York Giants.
Well, you know what? They actually, you know, everything. It's amazing that today with the Giants, it's all about the passing game with Eli, and their defense is nothing compared to what it was back then. But the
right.
couple of big-time pieces I saw added as a young guy watching the Giants, one in 82 they had already picked up Joe Morris, who in 1985 and 86 he was phenomenal as a Giant
yes.
running back. I always used to call him Tiny Earl. He reminded me of a smaller version of Earl Campbell. I mean, he had huge legs. He was a strong little guy running up there inside. And the other guy they had was in 85, Mark Bavaro, who was another guy who was tremendous that Super
yeah.
Bowl season. He had like 1,000 yards receiving. He was tremendous.
We thought Joe was tough. I called Joe the tough duck because I thought he ran like a duck,
right.
a little like a duck, but yet, you know, he was able to get it done. And Mark was a man amongst men. I mean, he was just, you know, Mark, you know, workmanlike attitude, you know, came in every day with a smile on his face. You know, they used to get tired of watching him walk around with one of these big-ass serving spoons and a big bowl of cereal almost every morning, but
right.
that was his thing. You know, that was his thing. The locker room was his solace, and that's where he, you know, was able to get his day organized and get his thing on track. And, you know, we respected him for that. You know, Mark was probably one of the hardest-working guys I'd ever come across, and we took a liking to Mark very early on.
Now, Joe Morris, back to Joe Morris for a second. In your experience being on the Giants, did he get hurt at a young age? Is that why? Because he ran for like 5,500 yards in his career. But in those 2 years, 85, you know, you guys wound up losing it to the Bears in the playoffs, and then you won the Super Bowl in 86. In those 2 years, he had almost like 3,000 yards rushing and 35 of his 50 rushing touchdowns in his career in those 2 years. All-pro, I mean, he was phenomenal. And then all of a sudden, he was gone before he really hit the age of 30. Was there an injury factor with him later on?
Well, he had some injuries down the road. You know, he had some injuries, but then he got into Bill Parcells' doghouse.
Oh, okay.
You know, and when you get to Bill Parcells' doghouse, it's pretty tough to get out. I mean, I had a chance to witness that in 1990 myself when I held out and wanted a little bit more money to stand there next to Lawrence and make it happen every weekend. And he put me in the doghouse and wouldn't play me, wouldn't start me every game for 10 ball games.
Right.
Until he really felt that he needed me to play. He put John Washington in the game so he could kill my start streak, which was at that time, I think, around 170 ball games and 160 ball games. And, you know, he told me why he was going to do it. And, you know, because I held out of camp and everything else to make a stance for more money, I said to him, you know, Bill, I play like Howie Long. I play like Richard Dent. I'm just not paid like them. And I think it's time that you pay me like them. And, you know, and that's what put us, you know, at an impasse. And the same thing happened with Joe Morris wanting more money. You know, the guy played his tail off. He worked hard as hell. He first guy in the weight room with me in the morning, and Phil Sims and Zeke Mowat, and the last guy to leave. And, you know, just didn't get the respect he deserved. And I always respected Joe Morris as a player for what he did, both in the locker room and on the field. But I respect him more because he was a guy who kind of, you know, if he thought he was right, he pretty much stood his ground, and that's what made me respect Joe Morris even more.
So as a player, were you closer to Belichick then, personally, if you had, like, some run-ins with Parcells in terms of contracts?
I never really had run-ins with Bill except for money.
Okay.
Parcells, that is. Bill Belichick and I had a I don't want to say love-hate thing, but we had a common ground and mutual respect. He loved the fact that, you know, I had this workman's type attitude. I didn't come in bragging or boasting. I didn't run my mouth during the course of the week. I let my game speak, you know, and any time it was time to step up to the plate and swing the bat, you can count on number 70 to be there to swing the bat. I mean, it's evident in my statistics. I mean, you know, I adopt that attitude that big-time players make big plays in big games, and they do it all the time with consistency. They don't just do it and not show up. They do it all the time, you know. Whether it was Super Bowl, whether it was the NFC Championship games, whether it was the conference divisional championship games, I was always a guy that you could count on to be there.
Well, the Giants won two Super Bowls in a five-year period, 2007 and 2011, but they won two Super Bowls in a five-year period also back then with you guys in 86 and obviously 1990. We just want to take a quick break. When we come back, we'd like to talk to you about those playoff runs. You'd be happy enough? Could you stay with us?
Absolutely.
I really appreciate it, Leonard. We'll be back after these messages, folks, with Leonard Marshall, two-time Super Bowl champion and second-team All-Pro 1986.
Sports Radio New York and AM 1240 WGBB are proud to announce the new Sports Talk 1240, along with the launch of a brand new website at sportstalk1240.com. Check out our new site for information about upcoming shows, as well as easy access to past shows, articles, our live studio webcam, and more. Of course, be sure to tune in to Sports Talk 1240 every Sunday night from 8 to 10 p.m. on AM 1240 WGBB, or visit sportstalk1240.com for ways to listen to the live broadcast online or from your iPhone. We're excited about these new changes and hope you will be too.
So you're looking for a great club but don't want to go into Manhattan, or you'd like to find a new restaurant to check out, or you're buying a house here on Long Island and you'd like to find out about a certain area. Wouldn't it be nice if you could find out all the information in just one spot? Well, you can. LongIslandExchange.com. It's all you need to find out all about Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com for hotspots, classifieds, news, and more. LongIslandExchange.com is designed with only the Long Islander in mind. Get the best of Long Island. LongIslandExchange.com. Discover Long Island all over again at LongIslandExchange.com.
If you're trying to quit smoking, dipping, or chewing tobacco, you don't have to do it alone. Nicotine Anonymous is a 12-step program of recovery that meets regularly in your area. There are no dues or fees. The only requirement for membership is a desire to be free of nicotine. For information and meetings near you, call 877-TRY-NIC-A. That's 877-TRY-NICA. Or visit nicotine-anonymous.org. Let us share our experience, strength, and hope with you.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240. Check us out every Sunday night at 8 p.m. right here on AM 1240 WGBB. And visit us online at sportstalk1240.com.
Making simple changes in your everyday travel choices makes a big difference to New York's air quality. Trip chain, use mass transit, rideshare, bike, or walk. Visit cleanairny.org to learn more. Clean Air New York, breathe it in. A public service message brought to you by the New York State Department of Transportation.
And now, back to Sports Talk 1240.
All right, we're back, folks, and Lennon Marshall stayed with us, so kind of him to do so, so we could talk about the big-time years with the G-Men. Now, Leonard, in 85, you beat the Niners in the first round of the playoffs, and then you ran into the Chicago Bears in the second round of the playoffs out in Chicago, shut out 21-0. Was that the worst playoff defeat that you had experienced, and how did you guys use that as fuel going forward? Talk to us a little bit about that.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, I think, you know, the Chicago Bear game was a measuring stick for us as a football team. I mean, we knew we were pretty good, and we knew that we had something special going on. We just didn't know how good and how special it was. We knew that we believed in each other and our abilities and our ability to play lights out ball. You know when provided the challenge, but we just didn't know how good we were. And I think that as a defense, we knew we had to carry our football team offensively because they didn't have as many weapons as we did. You know, we had a tight end that was emerging in Zeke Mowat. We had a running game that was pretty consistent with Joe Morris, but yet we knew it had to improve in order for us to be able to win. And we knew we had to be able to use the tight end position to get the ball down the field in big chunks of yards, aside from Joe Morris's ability to run the football. Our kicking game was good, and, you know, we had a decent punter that we acquired from the USFL and Sean Landetta,
right.
And the acquisition of Bart Oates in the middle playing center for us gave us some stability, and we didn't have to go out and find a guy to draft or develop a guy that we drafted. So some of those things were able to help us as a football team, but we, you know, when we came up against the Bears, we walked into a buzzsaw, and I think that they were a team that was ready. I mean, they were loaded, you know, from end to end on defense. The secondary was a veteran secondary in Fensick, Sean Gale, Dave Durison.
Durison was great.
And one of the other guys they had back there in their secondary. And then they had a guy in a playmaker back there who also was like a quarterback in Gary Fensick. So
right.
A guy had been around for a long time and saw the, like Harry Carson, saw the good Bears and saw the really bad Bears. And when the good Bears were starting to come around, you know, Fensick was a guy that was accountable.
Right.
You know, the same way Harry was accountable to us. So, you know, those things worked in their favor. They were an offense that had struggled for a long time, but yet they had a running back that, although he was aging, he could still make plays. They had a tight end, Emory Moorhead, that could do some things. They signed a kid to come in and help him by the name of Jim Thornton,
uh-huh.
who played tight end for him. And, you know, they were able to establish something as a football team, as a physical football team, with Mike Dick at the helm. So that game woke us up in that, you know, we didn't get beat defensively.
Right.
We got beat offensively and in our special teams.
Was Walter Payton the toughest running back you ever went up against?
Walter was one of the toughest that we'd ever played. You know, no guy really got 100 yards against our defense. We
right.
prided ourselves on that. He was a guy who had some consistent runs against us. But more importantly, the runs were critical in that they sustained drives for his football team and gave them a chance to make some plays. I think if you go back and look at the film and look at that game, Walter Payton probably had, you know, 62 yards in the entire game. Rushing against us. Their offense really didn't beat us. Their defense is what beat us. Their offense just was able to not make mistakes, and
right.
we couldn't force them into enough mistakes because we, as a football team, we weren't on the field a lot.
Right, and as I know, I could tell by listening to you that you respected Gary Fensick tremendously. Was there, who did you think was their best defender? Did you think it was Mike Singletary, or did you think it was Richard Dent?
I think the best defensive player, believe it or not, was their tackle by the name of Dan Hampton. I think Hampton was able to do some things inside
right.
that enabled guys like Dent to make plays, guys like Singletary to make plays.
Oh, yeah, Otis Wilson, yeah.
Right,
exactly.
But the most ferocious player they had, who had the most talent, the most speed and ability, was Wilbur Marshall, because he could line up anywhere and he could make plays from anywhere on the field. And he was undersized as a linebacker, but he was oversized as a defender or a defensive back. So you really didn't know how to deal with him. They put him in blitz situations, and he was so damn fast and so small that, you know, if you didn't know where he was pre-snap, you'd have a hard time finding him amongst all those big bodies that they had on defense. And
right.
the good thing they had going for him was that 46 defense that Buddy Ryan designed for
yes.
them, you know, with all those big bodies up front, you know, 300-pound, 320-plus-pound Fridge and, you know, 290-pound McMichael and 300-pound Hampton and 280-pound or 90-pound Richard Dent, you know. That scheme was just, you know, something that nobody had ever seen and nobody was ready to deal with.
Right.
And, you know, just like almost like the pistol offense, they perfected it to the point where, you know, you really couldn't make mistakes against the 46, because if you did and you messed up your blocking assignments or you didn't pick up in blitz protection, you know, they could take advantage of you offensively.
You know, you're right about Dan Hampton, because his nickname on the Bears was Danimal. That's what they called him. And you yeah. mentioned Wilbur Marshall. I'll tell you what. They took him in the first round also, right after the Giants took Carl Banks, 84
right.
draft. So you're right on with that. And just the way you described their defensive line. Now, listen, the Bears, they shut you guys out 21-0. You learned a lesson. You guys are moving forward. They went and shut out the Rams in the championship game 24-0. But
right.
when the Giants got there the next year, you guys took out the Niners, the high-powered offense, 49-3, before you took out Washington 17-0. And that's what was the essence of the greatness with these two defense. Now, getting more towards the 86 G-men, see, to me, when I watch, I was a linebacker like yourself growing up in high school, so I appreciated with guys like you and George Martin. It seemed like George Martin always scored a touchdown every now and then, too, from
yeah.
the defensive end. But you two guys and Jim Bird, it was all about disruption in the backfield, taking up blockers, and the linebackers were free to run and make plays. And that's what I loved about when I played in high school, that same kind of theory, and that's how you do things, by getting disruption in the backfield. So talk to us a little bit about going through that season in 86, and more importantly, you got your chance to take out Montana in 1990.
That's right.
But in this particular one, right before halftime, it was Jim Burt that laid one of the more devastating hits in playoff history. So talk to us about that playoff run, maybe even a little about the season, if you got any good stories for us in 86.
Well, I'll tell you, in 86, you know, 86 was a special year for us because, you know, as a team and as a defense, we knew we had something special. We knew that, you know, we could be something special. We could be one of the greatest teams ever in the history of the Giant organization because, you know, we had a lot of key weapons on defense that were coming back. You know, even though I held out of training camp and wanted more money, that year in 86, I came back in shape. I came back ready to play, and I came back ready to make an impact. And, you know, it was right after my first Pro Bowl season, and I wanted to repeat, you know, what I did the year before. So and I ended up doing that. You know, I ended up 12 and a half sacks. I ended up helping Lawrence get 20 and a half quarterback sacks. Combined, we had more sacks together than most teams in the NFL. I think there was like 9 teams in the NFL that didn't even have the sack total that he and I had amongst each other. So the biggest thing with that was, the best thing I remember from that year was, you know, we beat Denver at home. We beat everybody decisively, including the 49ers in the championship run, 49-3. But the most impressive thing to me that time was we beat our division rival, the Washington Redskins, 3 times in a row at our place, at their place, and here. And then the game here, the 17-0 game, I think I sacked Dre Schrader twice in that game. And one of the times that I sacked him, I dismembered him of the ball. It became a safety. Jim Burt recovered the ball in the end zone for a safety. And, you know, we sent a message to the league that, you know, hey, guys, the Giants are here, and they're going to be around and be good for a while.
How are they doing, Les? John Sweeney here.
Hey, John.
How's it going? On that 86 team and actually that defense you guys had, who was more involved in, was it Parcells or was it Belichick? Because it seems like Belichick's like a genius, defensive guru genius now up in New England and everything now.
Well, you know, that was mostly Belichick, to be honest with you. I mean, Belichick was just such a bright guy, and some of the schemes and the things that he designed and the things that he designed for Lawrence and I to do in the course of that season, we just picked up on what we learned that, of each other in 85. In 85, when Lawrence and I were, you know, starting to make plays and make offenses, have to now figure out how to deal with he and I, and you know, and then we had, you know, a guy that started to emerge into a player in Carl Banks. You know, somebody had to worry about on the left side of our defense along with George Martin. You know, now, the secret weapon's about to come out. And that was right. The deal with Bill. You know, Bill was, you know, he was the kind of guy that if he saw that you were a player to be reckoned with, he was going to give you more things to do and trust you and entrust you with more things to do to help bring your A game out. And he did that. He designed some things where Lawrence and I could work together a lot, you know, defensive line stunts, you know, games. We put in a couple of blitzes, up front blitzes that involved Lawrence, Harry and I, and Jimmy Burt that, you know, offenses had to deal with and had to try to figure out, you know, now you don't have just one or two bodies coming at you. You got four bodies coming at you, and they're all athletic.
You guys were devastating. Your defense was devastating.
Yeah, you know, yeah. And it was, you know, quick, fast, and it made plays. You know, we made plays as a defense. We took the ball from you. Or we caused you to make a turnover and throw us an interception, you know, leave the ball on the ground. You know, we just caused a lot of disruption amongst offenses.
I'll still never forget that hit on Montana. Can you tell us a little about that?
The 1990 NFC Championship.
Yeah, well, Lenny, in 1990, I mean, Montana, MVP season. Yeah. He won his MVPs late in the late 80s.
Yeah.
1990 MVP, he was 14-1 as a starter that year. I mean, they were supposed to clearly win that game at home. And your hit on him, I don't know if there was anything in his body that you didn't break in half on that sack. So let's talk about it for a while, because it's one of the more devastating hits in playoff history.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, again, I go back and tell you about walking through the progression. I mean, 10 weeks into the season, Bill Parcells wouldn't start me as a defensive lineman. He wouldn't start me as a right defensive end. And he did it to kind of teach me a lesson, more or less, as he said and told the media. He told the media I wasn't in shape to play when, in fact, I came in lighter than I had come in any training camp since I've been playing for the Giants. And we play San Francisco on Monday night, and we lose the game 7-3. You know, we lose the game by 4 points. You know, a touchdown beat us. A Jerry Rice sliding into the end zone, touchdown beat us. So I kept that in the back of my mind. When we got a chance to play them again in the NFC Championship game, we said that if we had an opportunity to make a play to change the game, you know, one of us on defense had to be the guy to do it. And it just so happened that in the course of the game, one of their players, who used to be one of our guys, Jim Burt, took a shot and hit Jeff Hostetler directly on his patella. He put his helmet right on his knee, his planted leg, which he could have almost broken his leg. And as a defense, we went into the locker room at halftime talking about it. And the guys were very upset and very disappointed what Jim tried to do. And they didn't think it was a personal thing, but some of the younger guys took it as a personal thing and said, you know what, in the locker room, if we get a chance to hit their guy, let's make damn sure that they realize, you know, what they try to do and put their guy in the hospital or deliver a blow that they'll never forget.
Right.
So, and when I got a chance to make a play on Montana, you know, I just tried to make a clean play to try to get us the ball back. Hell, if you go back and look at the play, I slip. You know, a guy tries to block me.
Right, you got blocked.
You were like down the ground, getting up,
yeah,
and then you boom.
I get up, and I'm crawling to try to get there, and you know, as soon as I crawl to get up, I look and I see he still got the football, and at the same time telling Jerry Rice to run. So I leave my feet, and my thing was to dismember him from the ball and hope that Mark Collins would catch it and make a dramatic football play and run it into the end zone and, you know, game over. But I do hit him. I do separate him from the ball, and Mark Collins kind of whiffs the ball, and we don't get the fumble. They get it back, but you know, I was hoping that we would have got it. It would have been lights out Irene on both levels. You know, one, you know, he never comes back in the game, Montana. And then two, we get the ball to put the game out of reach.
I'll tell you what, Leonard, man, I don't care if you got blocked, fell down, whatever. When you arrived, you arrived with a world of power and pain. In one of the, I'm telling you, it was a tremendous hit. I'll never forget it. I'll never forget the one Jim Burt delivered in 86. But yours was even more crucial because Montana, believe it or not, he was even more dominant that particular season.
Oh, yeah.
And that effectively was, listen, not like you want to try and hurt anybody on purpose, but the idea is to, you know, put as many hits on a quarterback as you can. That was always Buddy Ryan's theory.
Yeah.
Buddy Ryan coached with the Jets when they won their only Super Bowl. He observed how much time that Weeb Eubank and those guys spent trying to protect Joe Namath. And he said, man, if anybody's going to spend this much time trying to protect the quarterback, then my job or what I want to do is find a way to get a world of hurt in this guy's universe. And you know what? That's part of the game. And that was a big spot in that game. Let me ask you a personal question now, because you've said a few things about Parcells, and I'm like, okay, you know, I'm not too happy with what you're describing, and I'm not. But in terms of what you did performance-wise, regular season, playoffs, you had two sacks in the Super Bowl against John Elway. In this particular game against Montana, you had two crucial sacks in this game. One knocked him out of the game. When your career was over, or after he got his second Super Bowl title, Parcells, did he ever apologize to you for anything?
Never.
Really?
Never.
I find that very disappointing. If he would have apologized to you, I think I would have been a little happier.
You know, Len, I want to tell you an interesting story. We interviewed Raul Allegri on the show,
right,
and he told us a story that he was talking on the phone to his agent before in training camp, and Parcells overheard him, and he cut him because of that. And he was he was just telling his agent that I made the team and this and that. And Parcells was like, "What are you talking about?" And he took him in his office and he got rid of him. And then he brought him back after he wrote a letter or something like that. But I know I've heard the story before about Parcells being like that.
Well, I can tell and I'll say this to you, and not to correct, but you know, in the 86 Super Bowl, I had 2.5 sacks of John Elway.
Right.
One of the sacks I share with Lawrence Taylor.
Yeah, okay.
In the NFC Championship game, I sacked Montana 3 times. One of the sacks I share with Lawrence Taylor.
All right.
And I'm Defensive Player of the Month. I'm Defensive Player of the Week against his 49ers. And I'm riding the wave of trying to, you know, get myself to become the MVP of Super Bowl 25. And somebody made a comment about that. Someone made a comment that, you know, Leonard's played his ass off his entire series. He always shows up when his championship run. He's always the best defensive player on our team. And, one of the guys made it, you know, brought it up that, you know, every year the Giants had a banquet at the end of the season.
Okay.
And of all my seasons with the Giants, three of those seasons I was voted MVP of the team. Most valuable player of the team. 85, I was MVP. 86, I was MVP. And 1990, I was MVP of the team.
Okay.
Wow.
And all three of those years, I was voted to Pro Bowl on those teams. And one of the players, and I won't mention names, but one of the players said to me, "Has Parcells ever come up to you and ever said, you know, Leonard, you worked your ass off for me, and I want to make sure that you get everything you were supposed to get, you deserve to get, and I want the Giants to one day hopefully recognize you for everything you did for this organization." And I turned around and I told the guy, I said, "Man, you know, this is at the 86 reunion."
Right.
I said, "Dude, it has been 25 years. That man has yet to come up to me and say to me, thank you."
That's horrible.
I'm amazed. You know,
thank you.
I always respected his ability as a coach, but there's always been certain things I didn't like about him. And I'm actually, you know, I'm actually a little disgusted hearing about this because I've always seen how he treated Curtis Martin when Curtis Martin was on the Jets like he was gold. And I love Curtis Martin. Great person, great football player, had a hell of a career. But I also saw, and I'm just bringing this up because I just saw this documentary the other night about a guy that was drafted by the Giants who passed away from cancer, and you guys wore the number 38 on your helmet.
One of my best friends, John Tuggle.
John Tuggle.
One of my best friends, guys.
You know, and they showed Parcells talking in this documentary, and he actually teared up at the end, and I said, well, at least he's showing a little heart here. So that's why I asked you if he apologized to you, because I actually saw him show a little emotion in that documentary, but this was, you know, a very sad and tragic story about this guy. Can you talk about John Tuggle, though?
I mean, sure.
I know you knew him for a little while.
Sure.
But
when John Tuggle was drafted, John Tuggle was what they call, at the time, John Tuggle, when he was drafted, he came out of a school out of California. John Tuggle was a blue jean wearing surfer dude type kid that he and I became the best of friends on the team. I got involved that year with the Leukemia Society of America through a gentleman that I befriended from Westchester County by the name of Kenneth Worth. And Ken and I ended up working together on, you know, financial stuff. He, in turn, began to represent me in contract negotiations along the way. And the one thing we established that year was a chance for John Tuggle and I to work together, because John had come out to me and say to me, Leonard, they found out and discovered that I have leukemia. And hopefully I can beat this thing. And if I beat this thing, I'm going to be around for a long time, Leonard. So I befriended him. I introduced him to a young lady at the time that worked for Ken Worth, a young lady from Westchester County by the name of Sean Johnson. And he and Sean became the best of friends, and we would do things together on a friendly basis and everything else. And, you know, John was a kid that was spirited. You know, he had a big heart. He never thought that this thing would beat him. He thought he would beat it. And all that crap that video or that documentary talked about, while all that was good and fun and good for the public to see,
right,
I don't remember any of that.
Okay.
I don't remember any of that love, that adornment, the adoration for John Tuggle. I don't remember any of that.
Right.
All I remember is that, you know, when John got very ill, he didn't come around the team much. I don't know if it was they didn't want him to come around the team because they knew it would be a big emotional thing for the team and whether or not this group of young guys could handle something like that.
Right.
At that time or not, because this is 1984 when we first make the playoffs,
right,
as a football team under his leadership, you know, and he being Parcells. And, you know, we were trying to turn the corner, you know, trying to see who we were going to be and what we were going to be about. And, you know, and granted, he almost lost his job in 83 with the 3-12-1 season.
Right.
You know, because they didn't think he could coach at the next level. So there was a lot that came into play those first 2 years. And while John Tuggle was struggling with leukemia and us not really knowing 100% what that was all about for him, because he wasn't around the team very much.
All right.
So that was kind of odd when I saw that piece, but yet, you know, you have to respect it.
Yeah.
So, was it whose idea was it to put the 38 on the helmet that Super Bowl season? Was that was that a player's idea?
And then not necessarily a player's idea. I think it was a team idea. I think you know, somebody in the locker room had gone to Bill or to management and said that we want to honor John Tuggle and his fight and what he stood for and what he fought for. And how tough he was.
Right.
Because the kid was very tough. I mean, and the one thing I recall about him as a teammate, you know, in 84, we hired my college strength coach, a guy by the name of Johnny Parker.
Okay.
To become the official strength coach of the New York Giants. Johnny Parker, believe it or not, is the guy who built the 1986 Giants. And I don't care what anybody tells you, that team in 86 was bigger, faster and stronger than any football team in the history of the Giants organization because of what Johnny Parker had put into place and the work that Johnny Parker had did individually,
right,
and collectively with every guy on his team, from myself to Phil Sims to Zeke Mowat to Joe Morris to Eric Dorsey to you name them, every guy in that locker room, Johnny Parker has something to do with their health, their total wellness, their diet, and their outlook on the game,
right,
from a physical perspective.
Yeah, so he had a tremendous effect on the preparation, yeah, away from the field, the things the fans
big
don't
see.
Big
time impact. Yeah. Big time impact.
No, that's great. And I got to be honest with you, I think what you did is a giant and your career is great. And I don't think anybody who knows anything about football is ever going to forget that. But my partner wants to ask you a little bit about what you're up to now. Go ahead, John.
Yeah, I want to ask you what's going on now. And you tell me about the Game Plan Foundation a little bit.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, you know, I've been involved in several businesses outside of football, you know. And the one thing that I did while I was transitioning from the game was I got offered an opportunity to work at Seton Hall University and do a little bit of teaching in the Stillman School of Business. And I started working with Karen Boroff and Ann Mayo and Larry McCarthy and a few other great people in the Stillman School of Business. Rick Gentile, who worked with CBS and ABC and television for a number of years. And the one thing I did along the way is I always kept growing. I always continued my education and continued to get myself better and find better opportunities. And, you know, being a father, that's the one thing you have to do is find better opportunities and continue to try to uplift your kids through what you do. So along the way, I've, you know, owned finance companies, I've owned mortgage companies, I've you know, started, built, and sold companies and done several different things. The one thing I'm doing now, you know, I'm not teaching at Seton Hall anymore,
right.
But I started a fund, a franchise income fund, and trying to teach athletes how to invest their money. And, you know, most athletes, you know, want to be in business and want to be in the franchise business, whether it's Subway or TGIF Fridays, Bennigan's, FedEx Express, IHOP, Cracker Barrel, Chili's, Popeyes, Burger, McDonald's,
right.
You name it. Most athletes want to be in that, you know, and they just don't get offered the opportunity or they don't know how to go about getting into the business. You know, my thing with this franchise income fund helps with barrier to entry because it costs you $100,000 to get involved, you know, and with that $100,000 investment, you invest in a pool of franchises and you get offered an opportunity to spread your money around with minimum risk
right.
Involved, and I pay yield on your money on an annual basis.
Right.
I'll also pay it on a monthly basis if needed and if required to the tune of 7.5% of your investment.
Right.
It's a 10-year note. It's a registered security with the Securities Exchange Commission, and it's probably the most unique product there is on the market now. As we try to continue to live in a no-yield market,
right.
Or where we try to live without the middleman making any money anymore.
I hate to cut you off. I wish I had a two-hour show. We only had an hour. You spent the whole hour with us. I wish we had two. Listen,
we're still in touch. I want to talk about the Giants.
We're going to try and get you back on if we can around draft time, and we'll talk a little bit more and a little bit more what you're up to today. But I want to thank you for joining us and assure you that you are a legend in Giant Nation, and your achievements never will ever go unnoticed. Thank you for joining us tonight, my man.
Thank you very much. Brother.
All right, you take care of yourself.
Happy New Year, Leonard.
Same to you guys.
All right, you too. And folks out there, listen, an hour goes that quick. I wish we had more. But we will be back early February with another two-hour show for you. We'll get Leonard on in the future. But for now, it's a hockey town. We'll enjoy Tuesday nights. Rangers are on the team. Thanks for fans out there listening. We'll talk to you soon.
Jim, we'll
be back in February.
Tuesday, I on the Rangers. Here we go.
The views expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.